Welcome to Word on the Street, a weekly podcast from Barclays where our experts help ordinary investors make sense of the latest news and events impacting the world's financial markets.
Welcome back to Word on the Street. So we've got a great session for you today alongside the reassuring words of Will as ever. We're delighted to be joined by Ken Stusen, a partner at Brown Advisory and the manager of their large cap US equity growth strategy. So a great opportunity to get the thoughts of Ken and my team at a very timely point, I think it's fair to say, given the ongoing questions around the economy, quarterly earnings season, inflation, the election rates, you name it. I'll start with a quick disclaimer. Any stock or company names mentioned by Ken during this session should, of course, not be taken as a recommendation to buy or sell the shares. It's purely to bring the discussion to life. So, Will, delighted to have Ken with us, as I said. But before we get into the meat of things, do you want to just start with a brief recap of anything of note that's taken your
You said reassuring. You could be judging before you heard.
Teams.
You said reassuring.
What's
I could be horrified.
You or the team's views over the past week? Because there is a little bit. I'm just reading today. There's a bit of commentary around how some of that higher wage growth in the US might be fueling some further inflation fears, but not.
I think it's overdone a bit, that side of things. I think sometimes, you know, as you know, Miles, I think, you know, the problem is what we have is kind of lots of news and the demand for 24-hour news sometimes creates headlines where there are none. Inflation to two decimal places is the regular bugbear. We just don't measure it that accurately. And on wages, remember that the sort of transmission of that into inflation, yes, you know, if wages are running really, really hot, then the theory goes that consumers can therefore demand too much. It's a sign that the economy is running a bit too fast for its restraints. And so consumers can demand more than companies can provide. And so they need to get in the way of that and raise prices to kind of, you know, instead of because they can't increase supply enough. But it can work the other way around, that actually what you can find is that high wages can actually help incentivize companies to substitute, you know, bring in new technology in order to increase supply and actually, you know, so these things, they don't work as a kind of, you know, economists, I always think like just get way too fixated on having a model for the world, which we could stick to and we feel really reassured by it because I've got this understanding that goes in this box and so on. We need to be more comfortable with chaos.
That'd not be necessarily my, have that comfort blanket.
No, and I think the only other thing that we'd point out is that so far the earnings season has kind of corresponded a little bit to that idea that you are seeing a broadening beyond those, you know, some of the sort of very big names, that some of the sort of pep outside, the earnings pep outside of those is looking encouraging. And I think that's true also of the global economy to a degree. I mean, the manufacturing recovery is still a little bit kind of, you know, stop start. And there's nothing kind of, you know, it's not going gangbusters or anything. But the PMIs, some of the trade statistics, you know, some of this other stuff does suggest that that, you know, the incredible warmth of the US consumer, that that heat is spreading to the rest of the world, if not quite the British summer.
And there's a lot more data to come this afternoon. We're recording this on Wednesday.
I mean, literally, we're recording. Yeah, we got loads coming. But broadly speaking, that won't change anything. As you know, we don't rely overly on one data point. And just before Ken starts, on the weather, I was in the lift the other day and I told you this story. But as usual in a British lift, you know, everyone was prattling on about the weather. And this American guy just turned around and he goes, wow, like you guys are just obsessed with the least interesting weather system in the world. It never does anything but drizzle here. And someone retorted, au contraire, it's our weather system is perfectly designed for small talk. Totally inconsequential. There you go. There's my little nugget for the moment before Ken brings us genuine pearls of wisdom.
Yeah. So moving on from small talk and the weather, Ken, we'll get on to, in a second, maybe how you kind of think about managing your portfolio. But just while we're on the topic of quarterly earnings season, do you pay any attention or real attention to that at all when thinking about kind of long-term investings? Or is it more just something to keep an eye on and fuels the headlines?
First of all, hello, everyone. Good to be here. I think of quarterly earnings as a theoretical canary in the coal mine, yeah? So we are always looking at quarterly results in the context of, are we learning anything different? Or is this dovetailing with the long-term thesis? Now, what invariably happens when you're a concentrated manager like we do, we only have, you know, 30-odd names in the portfolio. If there's a little tiny scratch on the merchandise, we run it to ground, right? That might be an exercise. It might have to do with competition. It might have to do with a margin structure issue. It could be anything. It's important in a portfolio like ours, we are buyers of business models, of companies. So we better spend time worried about anything we might see that gives us a glimmer of the future, either positive or negative, by the way. It can go both ways. And so our analyst team digs deep. My general interaction with them is I don't necessarily, from my perspective, want you to spend a lot of time modeling out more of the same. But if there is something that looks a little different or is surprising, let's get involved. Let's run it to ground. Let's open the conversation to other commentators, as it were.
And I suppose you said there you have a portfolio of concentrated 30 to 35 names there or thereabouts. Now, thinking off the top of my cuff, I can't back this up. There must be 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 US companies that in theory you could own in that investable universe. So how do you get to that 30 to 35, and what really are you looking for in sort of the companies that you look to own?
There aren't that many names that are in my sort of, but your point is spot on. We have certain rules of engagement in terms of what attracts us to a business model. One is, and this is not saying it's right or wrong, but we put an actual absolute number on the kind of growth rate we're looking at. We are fishing in that part of the pond, if you will, where we can find 14% or better EPS growers through a full market cycle. There's always some cyclicality even to non-cyclical companies, right? And if you're looking at bottom line EPS, there could be a quarter where maybe they put more into R&D or whatever the case may be. 14 is not a magic number. 14 is 2 times 7. So, and 7 is the long-term EPS growth rate of the S&P 500. Okay, so we've decided to be, for the quarter of a century I've run this fund, to be a little bit more formulaic in what we're looking for. I don't think of Clorox or Pepsi as growth stocks. Some do, actually, and that's fine. That's their prerogative. But we're looking at really fast-growing business models. And so if you also think about, we are large-cap managers, and if the Russell 1000 growth is, you know, depending on what's in and out, roughly, I don't know, half that in terms of the growth side of it, that's a good jumping off point from our perspective. And so we don't want to confuse our investors who are doing asset allocation and say, I found this wonderful microcap company and we're getting involved. We simply won't. So it's a smaller number than you think. And the other thing is we're looking for is sustainable. These are not trades. On average, for many years, we've owned our companies for about a half a decade. So I like to say to people that we attempt to navigate the public equity markets the way a venture capitalist would, right? We're looking for great businesses. Now, we have a little more liquidity to get in and out of things and to resize positions. But we are fully, fully focused on the underlying business model. That is what drives us. And that is, frankly, why we've sort of lasted this long. We're not traders. We're owners of businesses.
And you've got good experience, Eddie. You've been running this strategy, what is it, coming up to 25 years or so now?
Give or take.
Yeah, yeah.
I started as a 14-year-old. I was a prodigy.
But it's great, right, because you see the experience of investing through various different periods. But that's a really useful kind of initial synopsis. How do you kind of monitor those companies once you've kind of selected them to own them? So is it a case of thinking, well, we set a price target for each, we look at the fundamental investment case. When you get near a price target, you might say, well, is that still justified? Should we come out of it? Could it just be a case that you find better use of capital and you switch as a result of that? Just
yeah, you've touched upon a number of important issues that might get us to change, to move out. I'd like to say I've coined this term and patented it, but I didn't put the patent work in. But we've talked about the notion of Darwinian capitalism, right? We want to create competition for our investors' capital. So there are scenarios where we will sell very, very good business models to buy even better ones. And that's really quite important from our perspective because I think people can get lazy, right? People like me love to talk to podcasters like you all, great little stories about CEO did this and told me that over a cup of coffee or on the golf course. And it comes to pass, and I remember this from business school, because a professor once said to me, the easiest way to rip off a quick thesis and get your PhD is to talk about the data that you see in mutual funds. Long tenured managers tend to allow the number of holdings to migrate ever higher. It doesn't make any sense. It's irrational unless you want to tell stories like that. Or maybe you want to run more money. It's really important in a process like ours to be consistent in the application of the process. So we've augmented it over the years. I think we have smarter people than when I first arrived. We use a London-based firm called Accenture that does behavioral analytics. We'll do everything we can to get better at our craft, but the general rules of engagement don't change. It's very commonsensical what I'm talking about right now.
Can I just ask, sorry, super interesting. And just thinking about individuals within that sort of within that business model, and you know, quite a lot of the sort of work that our manager selection team do, as you know, is kind of focusing on the structures that contain individuals and make sure that if you've got high quality individuals, they're allowed sufficient room to do stuff, but not too much room to sort of go too far. How much does that take a sort of part in your analysis of companies? Are you worried about people to a certain extent, or you're focusing mainly on the kind of, you know, the consistency of the business model? And when you talk about people getting lazy, it was an interesting comment, I thought.
I think, and when we do our due diligence, by the way, and I say this respectfully, we need to do a lot of upfront work because, again, as I gave the venture capital analysis, it takes us months to get to the finish line, to finish the job, okay? We don't leave on a Friday with a packet of sell-side brochures and go home and come back on a Monday and drop a bunch of trades. We tend to use the sell side at a point in time in our process when we are, quote-unquote, educated consumers of the conversations we will have. And so it's unacceptable behavior in our setup for someone to say, oh, the fellow from XYZ firm told me that this will fit in precisely with what Ken does. We don't do that. We run it to ground ourselves. We work in unison, myself and one or two or many analysts as necessary. I'm always very fixated on the behavioral aspect of this. Is someone selling me something, or are we getting holistically where we need to be in wanting to own this business model? We know from a behavioral perspective that analysts, we can say this to them at every firm on the planet, you're part of a bigger team. If the team wins, you wins, right, from a compensation perspective. But there's something in the back of people's minds that suggests the more names that I'm responsible for in the biggest portfolios, the more important I am and the more I'll be paid, right? That is a ruinous way of allowing a name to get into a portfolio. So at least we're cognizant of human behavior. The reason I talk about this is we are competing against the algorithms, right? I'm a human manager. We do deep, fundamental, bottoms-up, very traditional analysis, right? We better know what's rattling around in our own brains and our own biases, or else we'll be stamped out by the robots, right? It's really, really important to us. So we can go down this lane, but you know, the notion of, as we're doing our due diligence, I want to see the leadership.
See the whites of their eyes.
Yeah, if you will, but more than that, we can do all the work we can on what does the business model look like right now? Who are the clients? Who are the competitors? Margin structure, et cetera, et cetera. I want to know from conversations with management, their biases, how they react in different circumstances. You can look at two companies in the same industry, and we hit it. Let's say we hit a recession. There are some management teams who will say, batten down the hatches, blood running in the streets, we're going to cut and we will maintain our margin. Okay, well, it's good to know they have that bias. There are other management teams who will say, this is when our competitors are their weakest. We will spend more. We will take market share. I'm not suggesting one is right or wrong, but to your point about modeling these things out, doing upside downside scenario work, we better understand how these companies, even in the same industries, are slightly different, or else our work, our guesstimates, our scenario analysis will be frankly not that worthwhile. It's not going to tell us much about an individual company if we use the same decision tree on all companies.
Got it. Okay. Let's steer the conversation to the kind of thematic buzzwords of the day. So obviously I'm going to reference artificial intelligence, which, Will, you've spoken about a lot over the past few weeks and months. Do you buy into that long-term hype? How are you thinking about it? What kind of the pros, what are the risks? And has that fed into any of the kind of underlying security selection within your fund as well?
As you can probably gather, I don't look like someone who's sort of interested in hype. We're interested in facts and we're interested in things that have a high probability of coming to pass. I was telling the story the other day to someone, and I sort of kicked it off with, can you tell me the names of the two or three publicly traded 3D printing companies back in the day when that was a huge issue? Well, fast forward many, many years. Aerospace, automobile manufacturing, they all use 3D printing. I still can't tell you who the manufacturers are. Those machines are somewhat commoditized. It's the use of the technology that has been important for the companies. And I think of AI a little bit the same way, although there are plenty of differences. It's happening, right? But what it is, from my perspective as an investor, is there's sort of concentric rings, right? The center of the ring right now are these incredibly fast chips that allow what is essentially AI, the mining of information from data, correlations, et cetera, that can be done much more quickly. And therefore, it's quite useful in a quicker time frame. We own semiconductor companies that benefit from this. We own NVIDIA. We own the hyperscalers. I try hard not to be a jargon guy. These are the people who store our data, right? This is Azure, Microsoft Azure. It's Amazon Web Services. It's Google. Any company in the world that's using these people to vault their data will lean on them to come up with solutions. Because these companies are going to come to their clients in different industries and said, by the way, we have a really interesting way to sort of mine some of the data. It could be healthcare. It could be any number of things. Their customers are already paying them to vault their data. Well, they're going to be able to charge a few ducats more, right? And that's important for their growth rates, their profitability, et cetera. And then eventually, the use of AI will affect actual companies, right? They'll be better at what they do. If I may, I'll give you an example. There's a company that's been in our portfolio close to 15 years now called Intuitive Surgical. They make the Da Vinci robotic surgical system. When you talk to them or pose the question, what does AI mean to you? And I know it's corny, but I do that now with all portfolio companies when we see them. They will tell you that for about the last 15 years, every turn of the wrist, every movement of the fingers is vaulted. That data for every surgery is vaulted. So what can that provide them with? It can provide them and their customers, who are surgeons at the end of the day, it can help with training. You could, for instance, be a young surgeon who says, I'm going to be working on removing gallbladders with the Da Vinci. And the company could say, well, that's interesting. We can give you the four greatest gallbladder removers on the planet. You can learn their movements of their scalpel and the movements of your hand, who takes it out the quickest, smallest incision, i.e. less blood loss, less chance of infection, et cetera. That seems like a benefit to me. And then as you get further down the road, we'll be talking about this notion of again, using AI, augmented surgery, meaning in plain English, think of it as guardrails that would further eliminate mishaps. So if you were, and I've been able to play on a Da Vinci from time to time, it's amazing. It's amazing technology. But based on AI and based on mapping all of these procedures, if suddenly a surgeon is moving his or her scalpel to a part of the anatomy where they shouldn't be doing based on that what the surgery is, you can suddenly get sort of a perhaps a haptic charge of, are you sure about that? It's very important. I mean, from a health perspective, better outcomes, but from an insurance perspective, right? Imagine having sort of guardrails that suggest that surgery is even safer than it was with an already very safe robot. So these are some of the ways I think about how AI can be helpful and why it's worth investing in some way or form.
Good to have a similar thing with investing, really, wouldn't it? As they sort of start reaching for the Bitcoin button. Are you sure about that?
Fair point.
Don't do that. But that's a really good example, Will, and I guess is a different opinion or an expansion of the opinion that you've been making for quite some time in terms of this being potentially the start of the next industrial revolution, but also perhaps serves as a reminder that, you know, I'm sure everyone listening to this knows full well about NVIDIA, but maybe hasn't heard of some of those other companies. And maybe we're getting to a point where we might see some of that AI adoption start to broaden out a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. And it's fascinating listening to Ken talking about this, but you know, we're still at the sort of picks and shovels stage, you know, in the gold rush. Buy out the picks and shovels, and the picks and shovels very much are the semiconductor, these incredibly powerful semiconductor chips. at the moment. But I agree with Ken wholeheartedly. Over long periods of history, it's the adopters in a way. And you can see the gains from these technological breakthroughs quite far from the initial sort of epicenter of the breakthrough and all the excitement. And to a degree, you know, that's kind of, you know, the point, isn't it? That when you're trying to participate in a new craze, again, diversification is the key. You've got, you know, people like Ken and his team on your side, like find rooting out these incredible stories, not just at the epicenter, but, you know, elsewhere as well. And I would also suggest, you know, that's why we look so broadly across not just mega cap growth, and we ally, funds like Ken's fund with other funds that do different parts of the market and looking at those, and we bring them all together. And we think that's a very powerful way to do it. No recommendations here, either at the stock level or at the multi-asset class fund level. But you know what I mean? And I think that's kind of, you know, the overall message from history on these breakthroughs in the past is it's about humility and it's about being invested. And that's the sort of, you know, that's the exciting bit, is that your returns, if productivity is going to get an uplift, then investors benefit. Owning companies is the good thing. And that's, you know, another reason why we're saying, look, even though interest rates may look appealing, you know, in isolation, that actually lending to governments should be part of a wider portfolio where you've got commodities, stocks and all the rest of it. And that's the way to participate in an acceleration in global growth, if, please, it's coming.
Fingers crossed. And Ken, on that magnificent 7 point, I heard you talking about this the other week. You also referenced that it's been a bit of a hideout zone, I think, for some managers, but that perhaps over the next few years, there might be a bit more dispersion. There might be a bit more opportunity for the likes of you and other kind of active managers out there.
I absolutely think that's the case. I mean, this may not seem like a very insightful comment that I'm about to make, but the last several years have been somewhat unprecedented. As one of my investors reminded me, he said, not for necessarily old guys like you, but the next breed of young equity managers has never seen this before. Now, I've never seen a global lockdown, but I've seen rates higher in my career. And suddenly to have this series of events being compressed could be very frightening to people, right? And so the simple notion is, if I look like the benchmark, no one will fire me. Now, my investors would fire me because I would have broken sort of the compact I made with them. That is a concentrated manager who has an eye toward sort of tamping down excessive risk. But more importantly, you know, you can buy, big investors can buy a benchmark for a basis point or two. I've heard tale that if you engage in a sort of stock lending thing, they actually might pay you to own the ETF. So the Mag 7 have been a place to hide without getting in a lot of trouble. We're already seeing more breath in the market. We're also seeing, and this is really important from my perspective, we're starting to see the correlation amongst the Mag 7 begin to break down. Before, they traded as a single stock, which is extraordinary in my world, because you had one stock that was thought to be essentially this notion of the Mag 7, thinking of them as a single stock, perfectly correlated. They were a unicorn. They give you growth and they'll give you defense. And the special sauce is, my boss won't fire me if I look like the benchmark. So we're starting to see that breakdown, right? We, you know, some of the stocks haven't performed as well. Others, we talked about NVIDIA, have continued to do generally well. I don't need the Mag 7 to go to zero for a good relative performance. I just need people to realize, to get out further into the deep water, there are many, many great business models who, by definition, this is the old law of large numbers. The smaller you are, conceptually, the better chance you have to grow at a higher rate. Apple doesn't grow very quickly. I speak as someone who owned Apple for many, many years. And when I bought it in the tumult of the Great Recession, right? We bought, I think, two big chunks, and it was our biggest position for many, many years. The expected growth rate in Apple was about 16 to 17%. China was a down card. They basically had no business in China. Fast forward today, we can debate what the organic growth rate is. I don't know, 5, 6%. You can gin it up to, with buybacks, to 8% or so. We can't get to that 14%. It's a great company, world-class company. Students of business will be talking about it for the next 100 years. But it's not in my portfolio, and it won't go in the portfolio because that is not in line with the characteristics that we're expressing to our investors, which is 14% or better. That's what we own. Sustainability, in the sense that we give these companies that grow at that rate now a high degree of probability that because of innovative products, huge competitive moats, and a big addressable market, that they'll continue to grow at that level. So that's where we're focused on. And yet, from time to time, being sort of that sort of having that viewpoint, I should say, which again strikes me as rather commonsensical, can get you in a bit of trouble from a relative performance.
If I was listening to this, I think I'd just have one question on 14%, really random one. Why 14%? Why not 15%?
Well, just it's double the long-term sort of, you know, traditional growth rate of 7 in the S&P 500. I mean, we could make it 16.5 if we wanted to.
Yes. Decimal places.
But, yeah, let's get to the decimal places.
But that would would suggest an exactitude that we really don't have. I will tell you this. Some of the analysts on my team are big believers in rounding up, and I am really tough on them to prove that it is a 14% or better grower. And so I think the joke around the office is, well, does 12.9% round up to 13, which gets you to 14? It's like, no, stick with the process. It's important.
Cheeky.
Very cheeky.
Got it. I'm going to move on to the next on my list, and I'm not going to hold you to account on anything here, but we'd be remiss of us not to talk about the election. Now, I'm going to assume, perhaps rightly or wrongly, that you probably don't pay too much attention to who may or may not win. But I did hear you talking about some quite interesting comparison points the other day, which are perhaps relaying in terms of, you know, second term presidents. And it seems obvious on paper, but actually we kind of know in theory what we should probably be getting from either candidate, depending on who wins, shouldn't we?
This will be, in any human that strides the planet right now, the first time in anyone's life that an American president, irrespective of who wins, will have served as president before. As I mentioned, the last time it was Grover Cleveland.
Yeah.
Do you know what? I wrote down the date because I thought Will get excited about this. He loves his history. 1893.
He was the 22nd and the 24th president of the United States. Quite a comeback for old Grover. But so listen, when Trump was elected the first time, my fund underperformed. My companies had nothing wrong with them, but the initial response from the market was, this is what the Trump portfolio will look like. There were certain industries that people, you know, buy defense, short healthcare, things of that nature. None of that came to pass. I don't think in his first term, President Trump was much of an aggressive legislator in terms of what he wanted to, programs he wanted to see, et cetera. Now we're at a situation where we know the sort of history of both of the folks who have the chance of becoming U.S. president. So there'll be less mystery. But the point you bring up is this notion of the lame duck, right? This is a human reaction to uncertainty. If you are a professional politician in one of the two parties, or you are a professional government worker, you start to think about the future, right? Almost from the first day after the inauguration. Who's next? Will I be on the boat or will I be tossed into the water? And so history is a guide, and presidential historians would suggest, the party begins to slightly move away from the individual, okay? Not necessarily away from the party, but begins to fish around on who will be the next leader. Whose coattails should I be sort of latching my future onto? It's human behavior. People like to keep their jobs, right? And so I think that's important to remember. There tends to be less legislation done at the back end of that second term. And so I don't think this will be necessarily any different from in the past. But again, the knowable commodity that these two men are now. We've seen them in action. We know what they like, we know what they don't like, and I'll leave it at that.
Well played.
Very
diplomatic.
That sort
of chimes your views, doesn't it, Will?
Yes, I mean, I tend to, you know, I agree. And I think also, you know, the point we always make is that these economies are way too big, too various, too complicated to be in the thrall of one individual. You know, in a way, like the US economy has got so much preset momentum. And I tend to think that a lot of the kind of political history, if you look back at the UK or the US, quite a lot of it in a way is like the luck of being in the right paradigm when growth is accelerating, when a productivity enhancing innovation comes along or something. It's not all of it. Certainly policy can help. But, you know, actually the next president, whoever that is, may well benefit from the idea that actually productivity for the first time in a while is picking up. Things look a bit better than they have done. And the US economy, let's face it, it still looks in intimidatingly good health. So there's not, you know, there's a few cracks here and there. You know, we talked about, you know, commercial property, office, real estate, you know, some parts of the, you know, there's some parts of the sort of lower income distributions where you're seeing delinquencies pick up in car loans and so on. But the reality in aggregate is that the US private sector remains in very, very good health. There aren't the signs that the next recession is close, which probably means tomorrow it's going to crash into the largest epochal recession ever seen.
The commentator's curse.
Yes, but no, I mean, you know, in terms of stuff that's sort of visible, you wouldn't be worried. I mean, yes, interest rates are high and they must be putting strain on parts of the economy that we can't yet see as well. There'll be, you know, there'll be, I'm sure, houses of cards that have been assembled too fragile on the basis of low interest rates forever. But for the moment, things look pretty good. And actually that pickup in productivity, and you're starting to see it in some of the investment, and Ken talked about the CapEx. I mean, I think of the three that reported last week, you've got about $140 billion of CapEx expected, you know, in terms of the AI story and related. And I think it goes up to about $200 billion if you look at the big six, big seven. So there's now you're starting to see companies pour in as well. I think, you know, again, innocent till proven guilty. And that's the most important thing about, you know, for investors to pay attention to, not who's going to be in the Oval Office or who's going to be in the Fed chair. Think about the productivity story in the economy.
Got it. And then, Ken, just to wrap up, how are you thinking about the future and on a kind of overall level, how would you say the fund is generally positioned in terms of overweights and underweights?
I would first tell you to be a growth investor is to be optimistic about the future by definition. You know, today, the portfolio, and I'll drill down a little bit, we're sort of about equal weighted on software. We are overweighted in healthcare. And it's some of that is device. Some of that is sort of the selling picks and shovels to the miners who are, you know, drug developing. We own a company called Zoetis, which is an animal pharmaceutical company. The humanization of the household pet is a real issue. You should ask Mrs. Stusen about that. She has her two Airedales are treated better than most children in the world. So as we go forward, the economic backdrop is, as Will suggest, very, very good. And these are growth stocks. And generally speaking, it's less cyclical growth, right? It's taking advantage of a market opportunity. And so even if we have a slowdown, not that they won't be dented a little bit, but this is not like a metal bending business, right? Where revenues can drop off to nothing, high fixed costs, suddenly you're at a big loss. That's not the kinds of companies that we own. So I'm generally sanguine about where we are right now. And I think the point about, you know, who's in the White House is secondary to other issues, right? We points or so, if that's the case, will have a terrifying effect than going from essentially zero rates and to have someone actually raise interest rates, right? That was truly like, call it
a wow moment.
It's like sunspots for primitive man, right? It's the end of the world. And I think that's the way people reacted for quite some time. So I'm generally sanguine. Listen, the Darwinian point I made before, if we see cracks in business models, we sell them, and we sell them quickly, and we move on to better ideas. And that's always been the case.
Fantastic stuff. Look, thanks again so much for coming on. We really appreciate your time. I think we have hit time today, so we'll leave it there and we will speak again next week.
All investments can fall as well as rise in value, and their past performance is not a reliable indicator of future performance. This podcast is not a personal investment recommendation.